Hello.
Hello.
Greetings.
Salutations. So, Dan.
Yep. That's me.
Are you afraid of no ghosts or some ghosts?
I don't go to Chinatown and I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
Yes. Yes.
To quote the not Ray Stantz cameo. I would probably be afraid of ghosts, to be honest. If I saw floaty vomit woman from the first act of this movie, in all of her glorious neon color, spit green goo all over me and or somebody else, I'd probably be pretty freaked out.
Yeah, you know, it's not so much the ectoplasm as it is the fact that the ectoplasm is not video safe. It is.
That seems to have been an active choice in this movie on many occasions. Like the what do you call them? The proton pack beams or whatever. They are massive, like sensor clipping look to them.
Yeah, everything's pretty clippy, you know, and not like the helpful assistant that we all know and love, but just like very aggressive.
Yeah, I mean, the neon color palette is nice looking, I guess, but at the same time, yeah, that the clippy, I don't quite understand what that choice was all about, because the original certainly didn't do that, but then, you know, it was more film related things and the way it was optically done and stuff.
Oh, you're talking about the original movie. I thought you meant the theatrical release, which wouldn't have clipped this because we're watching it at home video right now.
I mean, actually, I didn't see this in theaters, so I could not comment on such a thing.
I saw it in theaters, and I don't recall it having...
You saw this in theaters?
Yeah. Why did you say it like that?
I don't know. I feel like a lot of people didn't see this in theaters.
I mean, evidently, not a lot did, but some did. Some people did. It's vibrant, but I don't know what's going on. I mean, I don't have an HDR reference monitor to review the material on at my home, so maybe some of it is just like it was mastered incorrectly for home video, because Sony seems to have wanted to disappear this into a memory hole at a certain point now.
A little bit. It is very difficult to search in various places. Like, this doesn't come up at all in the TV app on Apple devices, right?
It does. If you say Ghostbusters 2016, then it'll show up. But you have to add that 2016. Otherwise,
you shouldn't have to add the year to the movie in order for it to show up as a search result.
No. And if you type in Ghostbusters into like the search bar in Safari, like the first thing it tries to suggest to you is the Wikipedia for the 2016 movie.
Is that right?
Yeah. So it's interesting how everybody has chosen to remember this.
Isn't it
complicated?
Like, I mean, what's up with the you can't name multiple movies the same thing twice? This movie's just called Ghostbusters, which should have the problem with the original one.
What?
You can't name multiple movies the same name. That's a rule.
I mean, it's not a rule. There are a lot of movies that are named the same thing.
But they usually yeah. Add like a "the" in front of it or something. Like, this isn't the Ghostbusters in order to avoid that confusion.
Do you want to know what the newly released sequel to Scream is named?
It's called Scream, which is also stupid.
Yes. There are no hard and fast rules about this.
I thought there was an actual like union rule about this.
No. No, no, no.
I don't know. I think there's a rule about this.
No, there are a lot of movies that are named similar things. I mean, in terms of the Ghostbusters and that sort of thing, part of that is just polluting the namespace, you know, a little bit for people is not great. But at the same time, there are some sort of issues that were not reckoned with at the time that the movie went into production. like, it's, you know, sort of subtitled Ghostbusters Answer the Call, which is sort of...
Who's answering the call? They are?
It's not Kevin, but it is...
I get it, because he doesn't understand phones.
No, maybe he answers it and then he hangs up because he doesn't like the conversation. But the weirdness there is, like, they have this movie. Sony had this movie because Sony is Columbia Pictures. Sony has the rights for Ghostbusters. They're very excited to do things with their franchises that they have.
Is this the first movie that is under the Ghost Core company name in the opening credits? I don't think they used that in the original ones, did they?
Not to my knowledge. So anyway, they wanted to make something, and Bill Murray did not want to make anything for a long time because Bill Murray is obstinate and difficult to work with.
It's not just because he's an artistic purist and doesn't want to ruin the legacy that they have created with the original two that is so beloved.
I mean, I think there's also a lot of like historical rewriting of things because not everybody loved Ghostbusters 2. It was not as well received as the original Ghostbusters film. And yeah, even at the time, the reviews when it was released were mixed and some were negative. And I think that's part of the reason why Bill Murray wanted to distance himself from that and not do another one of these. He's kind of a pain in the butt in general in a lot of ways. But that wasn't the biggest problem because Harold Ramis died, being a bigger problem. And so, you know, Sony being motivated by money, much in the same way as when we talked about Warner Brothers and Matrix Resurrections, you know, they've got this intellectual property that they can mine, and it is theirs to do with as they see fit.
They're just real sad that Ramis died and put a damper on their whole reviving the franchise.
No, I mean, I don't know if I would ascribe any sort of emotions to the lawyers and accountants that make up the upper echelons of Sony Pictures Entertainment, but it is a situation where it was made more awkward for them to do something with the original cast. Instead, they chose to go a different direction, and that sparked a lot of unfortunate stuff, because part of the new direction was also rebooting it rather than having it be a sequel in line with the others. And I think that might be a thornier, trickier issue to parse out here in terms of the reception of the film, is if this film had been a continuation of or in the same world as the original Ghostbusters film, as opposed to a reboot where there is a different team of people who are the Ghostbusters who arrive at sort of the same situation, same scenarios, and do the same sort of stuff by the end of the film. Does that fulfill what people who were fans of the original want? And does that also satisfy modern day audiences who are looking for new and different things?
Yeah, that's the big question around this property, isn't it? Like, practical difficulties aside from continuing the franchise where it was, will the world tolerate the full reboot of this intellectual property, starting over ostensibly with a new group of people? And I think we answered that question. The answer is no.
No. It was a firm no. But there's also...
You go ahead. I've got nits to pick, but like, mm-hmm. Yeah, you go ahead.
Yeah, but I mean, we can't even get into talking about the movie until we talk about like
talking about the movie.
Yeah, exactly that. Because the discourse around this is not good. It is very polarized, and in ways that are not conducive to artistic critique of the material that was generated by this process of making the film. What we have to review, it is made more difficult to review by virtue of the fact that it has been thrown into a toxic cesspool, dragged out, and then road hauled down some sort of toxic waste dump area.
Lines were drawn in the sand for no reason whatsoever.
No, well, not for no reason. I mean, it was well established by this time going into 2016 that there is a toxic element to internet discourse, which is primarily focused on sort of these misogynist male tendencies of protecting, you know, white, masculine, whatever identity of things. And some people, for whatever reason, had decided that that would be video games and other things. And then, of course, Ghostbusters, obviously, because why wouldn't Ghostbusters be the thing that you would tie your personal identity to?
Well, there
as an
a lot
adult
of people who grew up and have memories of the mid 80s who were of loud caps lock Twitter and Reddit age when this movie came out, so I think it's kind of coincidental.
Yeah, but at the same time, because of this toxic stew of crap of these people, you also had a reactionary thing of people who sort of like believed in it as a cause, as like a thing to gather around to circle the wagons to defend. And yeah, it made it very difficult to talk about the flaws in the film, because you instead are forced to pick a side here where you're like, oh, yeah, are you with the toxic wasteland trolls, or are you with the protectors and defenders of the one perfect movie? And yeah, it's like I can't ally myself with either of these two choices.
It's too simplistic to say that we live in a two-party system and one party hates the movie with a fiery passion and wants to burn it to the ground and destroy its memory, and the other party wants to uphold it as progress towards an ideal state in the world. That's too simplistic, but that's kind of what it felt like at points.
And it's one of the reasons I believe I don't have, because we don't pay for it, the ability to search our past discussions about this. I know we had talked about potentially doing a conversation on this movie when it was coming out, but the conversations that existed were so charged at the time about the stuff that had nothing to do with the film that it didn't feel like something we would do. Wow. So that's one of the reasons why we haven't talked about it until now.
I mean, there are many reasons. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like we can talk about this now. I feel like I'm dumb enough and have a bad enough memory that I can kind of divorce the context a little bit from the movie itself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you feel that you're able to watch this with sort of fresh eyes? I mean, it's good that we're addressing the discourse here, and I have more to say on it. But did you feel like you were able to watch it this time without that ever present in your mind?
No. Well, no. But I this is one of the reasons why I didn't want to talk about it when I had originally seen it, because I didn't love the film when I saw it. It has problems. And I just don't want to contribute to the perception that I am against the movie because of reasons that are outlined by the, you know, horrible people. I don't want to be on that side of
you don't want our
stuff.
Audience to believe that that's the side you've chosen.
Yeah, like I also don't like The Last Jedi. But that doesn't make me a bad person. And I don't, you know, want to be associated with the people who hate The Last Jedi for reasons that are not having to do with the actual material of The Last Jedi. It's a similar sort of situation there, where people who are fans, allegedly, make these really hard and fast statements before they even see the thing. And then you are forced into these camps of either picking, you know, praising it without any reservation, or being this nasty troll of a person who says awful things to the cast, you know, and torments them. Like, just reading from Wikipedia here, on July 19th, Twitter suspended the account of Breitbart writer Milo Yiannopoulos. Remember him? What a blast from the past. Who had criticized Jones allegedly for abusive behavior over the previous 48 hours. Conversely, Jones and her character in the film were also accused of promoting negative stereotypes about black people. Like, what? Where do you insert yourself into this conversation? Where you want to be like, I want to be a part of the whole zeitgeist of discussing this Ghostbusters movie.
This is a movie, people. Like, I think this was probably a lot of the discussion at the time before it got so out of whack that we had to pick sides. We don't need to pick sides. It's a movie. We can talk about it as art, in the same way that you and I, well, I assume you, I do my best not to tie my self-worth to the work that I do, because I would feel really bad about myself a lot of the time if that was the case.
I learned that lesson a long time ago. That ship has sailed, my friend.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we all learn that lesson repeatedly over and over. And like, you end up getting really excited about a project, and you can accidentally fall back into that. But, you know, this doesn't need to be. This is not a battle of identity. I mean, I know so many people turned the Ghostbusters franchise into such a core part of their identity that they felt like they were being attacked and they were fighting back against it. But that's just stupid. That's the way a 10-year-old thinks. And I think that's partly that's partly some of the sides that we were on here, the people who refuse to grow up and act like an adult about certain things. But you know, it's at the end of the day, it's just a movie. We need to be able to talk about the movie as a movie and not as a core tenet of society or our individual identities. Like, it's Ghostbusters, guys. Like, it's a fun movie from the franchise from the 80s, but like, making a Ghostbusters movie that you don't like doesn't, like, it's not like murdering your dad or something. Like, we're not doing anything to you. We're if anything, it should be overtly obvious that this is a cynical Hollywood cash grab. Like, chill the hell out. We're not trying to make some sort of statement. We're just making a movie, and it either works or it doesn't, but it's not about you necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting. You chose to use the word we there. Because
the royal we Hollywood, yeah.
We, the royal we, Hollywood, Dan and Joe, we had nothing to do with the production of this. Although I know a lot of people who worked on it. Dan Kramer, who was a VFX supervisor for Sony Pictures Image Works on this. I knew of, but never really worked with Dave Seeger, who was at Image Works, who left to be at MPC, and work on their stuff for this. And there are a lot of other people in the credits who I recognize, including some who don't wash their hands when they go number one in the bathroom.
You want to call somebody else?
No, I don't want to call anyone out, but you know, if you're listening to this, you know who you are. Although I highly suspect that the person is not listening to this. But yeah, it is, it's tough if you're working on this, but it's also tough if you're just like a fan of wanting to watch a movie and talking about the movie afterwards, as we do on this program, on, you know, at least 300 occasions so far. And it is challenging to have that sort of discussion when you have to try to couch it, every little thing you say, so that you are not supporting the arguments of some disgusting dirtbag like Milo Yiannopoulos, or creating some sort of weird, surreal reality where critique cannot possibly exist. And I just would choose personally to wait for these highly charged movies to be over and done with before we, you know, dive into them, as we did here, because it is easier, I think, to have this conversation now, because people who are going to listen to this may not be as charged up, potentially, to engage in either assuming that things that we say that we did not like about the film are because we're toxic, hateful people, or, you know, conversely, that we are just trying to get in on a tidal wave of, you know, interest and conversation about a hot button topic. Because I don't know about you, but I never want to be a part of a hot button topic. I don't want our podcast to trend on Twitter.
Oh, you don't want us to be the main character for a day?
No. No, no, no.
No.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that's where I kind of come from, is just like, I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. And it's except for, I guess, Milo, it's fuck him. But yeah. I want to have a conversation that is, you know, a real conversation about the flaws in the film, as we've had real conversations about the flaws in the original Ghostbusters film and Ghostbusters 2. Because remember, Dan Aykroyd wrote a scene where he gets a blowjob from a ghost.
I thought you were going to talk about all the see-through matte painting stuff, but yeah, there's that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm just saying, like, these are not, like, perfect things that are beyond reproach. We need to be able to talk about them. Is just where I personally feel like we need to be as a society.
Yeah, remember when the ghost of Janosch is dressed up like an old lady with a baby carriage and flying around?
Yeah, because
that was weird.
That was just what one did at the time, apparently.
Yeah, and Vigo. Yeah, so it's unfortunate that we have to preface this entire review of this movie with basically saying, any criticisms of this movie does not mean that we hate the filmmakers and the actors and hold a grudge against them for life, because we're not children here. We may do and say a lot of childish things on this podcast, but it's all in jest, because we're not assholes.
Yeah. Yeah. And with that said, I believe, like, we have given this enough of a, you know, a preface, if you will, about this situation, that we can move on to discussing the film itself, and not have to couch every comment. But if at any point you're listening to this and you're like, Joe and Dan are being mean, they're meanies, I want you to just remember this first 20 minutes of the podcast we dedicated to talking about how we're not trying
to hurt anyone's feelings.
Yeah.
We're two idiots with a podcast and we have opinions, and our opinions are null and void outside the context of this podcast.
Yeah. Also, you know, it's art. Just like, you gotta live with people saying things. And
we're not calling for any action outside of our discussion here.
No.
We're just expressing ourselves.
Yes. And so
I do want to circle back a little bit, now that we have that out of the way, to this idea that studio has the Ghostbusters intellectual property and they want to make another one. What do they do? And it seems like, you know, again, this is 2016. So Mr. Paul Feig is at the height of his powers, presumably. You know, you got your Bridesmaid, you got your Spy. Like, what was the other one he did right in a row right there?
Was it The Heat? Or Heat?
Yeah. I enjoy a Bridesmaids and The Heat and Spy. Like, those are fun movies. I don't quite know what transpired for them to think, you know, okay, actually I do know. So the whole, like, idea that, like, he's going to be the guy to usher in this new era of Ghostbusters. Like, you know, they probably sat around thinking, like, or the original Ghostbusters, we got a bunch of SNL guys. Like, there's actually a fair amount of, you know, riffing and ad-libbing, because, you know, the original Ghostbusters, they didn't really know what they were making. They were trying to find some of that stuff in the edit and to become what it became. So they got some funny people. They sort of let them play around a little bit, and they had this sort of general idea of what it was going to be. And they went out and they had some fun with it, presumably. And the modern incarnation of that is, again, pulling some SNL talent, pulling the, I don't know, the SNL adjacent sort of comedy performers of the time, and bringing them into the fold. Now, obviously, it's a different generation. I mean, we're several generations away from the original, so it's going to be a different brand of filmmaking and comedy and just general storytelling. But I can see the logic in why they went with the cast they went with and the production crew that they went with. It just didn't land here. And I'm curious this is the whole point of our discussion. I want to know what you think is the reason it didn't land as well as the first one did. Is it just expectations? Is it execution? How you felt about it in general, I guess. But do you have an opinion? Do you have a feeling of why it didn't land the same way that the original did? Because the recipe was sort of set up in the same way that the original one was. Am I off base there?
No, I mean, it is essential to this franchise that it is a comedy picture. Like that's what is here is comedy. You need to have comedians. They need to be funny and doing comedy stuff. You need to have a director who understands comedy. However, I'm going to say my first pretty unkind thing, and that is
the Band-Aid off.
Yeah, it's just Paul Feig, unfortunately, God bless him. He can get like sort of medium funny things out of the actors and let them like work through some stuff. But then he doesn't really know how to refine or pick through that to whittle it down to be a thing that is more focused. And
yeah, I think there's a clarification just to make there between refine and whittle down. Like he's got a lot of content, but while shooting, he's not able to go like, ooh, that's the one right there. Let's drill down on that a little bit and make that the best version of the thing it can be.
Yeah, because there's some stuff in here where I wonder if it's just like, well, I wish I had shot a different take or whatever, because I have this whole long thing and I can't cut this part because then that won't make any sense or something. But
do you have the same thing where I do, where you can see the lines where you're like, this is straight up an ad lib. There was no additional thought given to this and it's in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of clear in some parts when one of the other actors who's in the frame will start to sort of suppress a giggle as if they are on SNL. Mm. And I wish that Paul Feig had been like, well, let's do another take of that. I like what you did, and let's, you know, play that back and do it over again. But this time we're really going to like focus on hitting it out of the park. And he may have done that in some of these scenes, but it doesn't come across that way. And there's also a dearth of material that has come along the way with what are some funny moments in here where you have a lot of other stuff that is sort of like medium funny-ish, sort of like bubbling around the edges of it. And it's like, well, did you need that for the scene? And the answer is usually no. There is a extended version of this because we should preface this conversation also, the preface to the preface. When I signed up for Movies Anywhere and when Dan signed up for Movies Anywhere, I think, at least we think, this is a theory, that is when we received Ghostbusters 2016 as part of joining Movies Anywhere, because there were some promotional films at the time that were given out for free, because I have no recollection of purchasing it, and neither does Dan. Yeah. So this got U2 albumed into our collections, and it has by default an extended version of the film that it will play, which is not the theatrical release of the film. I did not realize until I was watching it, because Dan had even warned me about this first, that I was watching the extended release version. I was like, well, I don't remember that thing. I don't remember that thing. And then I was like, oh, this is for sure the long one. And apparently you need to drill down into the iTunes extras to get to the original theatrical cut. Now, do I think that the theatrical cut is a more focused and refined thing than the longer cut?
More concise.
I'm going to say not really. There is actually some stuff in the longer cut which uses different takes than what's in the theatrical cut, which is a decision that I do not really understand. Because
it's not called the director's cut or anything. It's just called the extended cut.
Yeah. So it's, I don't know who made the call on doing these decisions, for adding or swapping material in here. Like even in the opening scene, Zach Woods, tour guide guy, he has a different thing he says. He doesn't talk about, he talks about how this was one of the first houses that had, like, what was it, like a perimeter fence to keep out the Irish or something. It was like a weird little joke that they were putting in there, that he delivers straight, and that was supposed to be the joke. But in the extended version, he instead points out a clock that was on the Titanic, which was saved by Aldridge at the expense of several other women and children who were not allowed on the lifeboat because it was protecting this clock. And that is the joke there. And they are not equivalent. So I don't understand editorially the exchange that occurred there. But then you have other decisions where part of the character backstory for Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy's characters is that they grew up together and they believed in ghosts, and Kristen Wiig saw a ghost when she was a kid, and she talks about that in the extended version of the movie, which is not in the theatrical cut. And they put on a performance of their little, I think it was like a science fair project thing, you know, where you get the like trifold cardboard thing, and they put on black turtlenecks to reenact the photo that they had of them as children, and they do the performance, and then it cuts to them looking at the news broadcast. In the theatrical cut, they are just in black turtlenecks watching the news. And you don't know why they're wearing the black turtlenecks. And there's also the dancing, which is in the credits of the theatrical cut, but is also actually in the movie in the extended cut.
Which is, it's, to be honest, in the theatrical cut, it's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
When what's his name? Kevin?
Mm-hmm.
When he floats down to the front of the hotel and freezes all of the police and the army in a sort of disco pose, and then that's the end of that. The Ghostbusters are there now. Like, that's, first of all, I think I saw a lot of the dancing in the trailer, and I thought it was going to be in the movie, and it was not. But it very clearly seems excised from the film. Like, it seems like something is missing there.
Yeah. And that is a decision that I'm not sure. I don't think that was Paul Feig's decision to remove that. I believe that was more or less seems like the sort of thing a studio note would come through to remove that.
I wonder if they just got a lot of notes like, the movie's not tracking great, so we need to make sure it's under 2 hours so people don't go, oh, it's over 2 hours and it's boring. Yikes, can't do that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not sure they cut the appropriate things, because I would have kept the dance part in.
Hmm.
There's also Kristen Wiig has a boyfriend in the extended cut.
Oh, really?
Yeah, who is not in the theatrical cut.
Where does he appear in the extended cut?
He is at the beginning of the movie. Kristen Wiig goes into a like party thing, like a university party, and she is nervously talking to her boyfriend, and the boyfriend introduces her to this other lady, and the other lady has a book published. Oh no, not a book published. Has won awards, and so she takes the opposite opinion of everything that Kristen Wiig says, and it undermines Kristen Wiig, and she feels less confident in herself. And then she,
I was going to say, was that character played by Cecily Strong? But Cecily Strong is played, you know, the mayor's aide. So
right, no, this is somebody else. I don't remember the actress. Then the boyfriend appears again when she's being fired from the school and she's walking down the hallway. There's a longer version of that scene, believe it or not, where she is saying she's not really being fired, and that it just looks like the cliche where I have a plant in a box, but it's not that. It's not that I'm being fired. And she goes past her supposed boyfriend, and he turns around and pretends not to know her and is inspecting a chart on the wall. And then later on, he shows up to talk to her when they are at the temporary base above the Chinese station, where they're going to go, a Chinese restaurant where they're going to go to do the thing, put on the jumpsuits for the first time. And he intercepts her there and says, "You're not really going to do this thing, are you?" And she's like, "Oh, you didn't stand by me and stuff." And that is theoretically more character building stuff that could have been in the movie. But I will say that unfortunately, because Kristen Wiig is playing her character as someone who lacks confidence, she is riffing on ways to make her character awkward in every scene. And Paul Feig either did not ask her to whittle it down to something specific, did not ask her to refine it to something specific, and didn't really whittle it down in editing to something specific. So instead, you either have the extended version of the movie where there's too much of that, or you have the theatrical cut where the boyfriend doesn't exist at all.
Do you remember who plays the boyfriend, by the way?
No, I don't. I wonder if he's in the credits.
I'm just looking on IMDb. I don't even, do you remember his character name even?
No, I don't. But he had a very, very small role. But he, I mean, I'm sure he's bummed. But the, you mentioned Cecily Strong. And I do like her. I believe she is the same in both cuts. But
yeah, but this gets to another thing where, you start to see this cast of characters that we're all familiar with come into this movie, and you're like, okay, here we're in a different SNL riff skit here. And don't get me wrong, like I enjoy some Paul Feig. I very much enjoy Spy, and The Heat's fun. Bridesmaids is a good movie that I don't enjoy watching just because I don't know, it just doesn't make me feel good to watch it. I don't know. I don't like watching these types of scenes. And one of the things that I think this movie was missing that I think sort of it exists in the original Ghostbusters just by virtue of the fact that it was the 80s and things were slower and people were a little bit more sad or something. But this movie doesn't really have the serious moments in between the comedy that I think really like give you a moment to take a breath and just all of the borderline slapstick. Can you have slapstick dialogue? That's not really a thing. But like, it just, I don't know, all of these scenes stitched together, there's just never a moment to sort of like connect with people. And it's not just that they lack character development. It's, I mean, it probably is what I'm asking for is character development, but they're just, they lack seriousness at every turn, which just keeps the whole thing just, it's light the whole way through for 2 hours. And you just never, you never really have an opportunity or a desire to, I don't know, invest in them as people. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I don't believe it is a symptom of SNL-ification of things because, I mean, the original cast, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, and, you know, Rick Moranis was on SCTV. Mm-hmm. So, like...
which is why, again, I don't want to give anything away, but I'm looking forward to potentially discussing the next one after this because I think there's something to the filmmaker himself bringing a little bit more filmmakeriness to it on top of the SNL-ness to sort of balance things out. Whereas I think Paul Feig is still very much just in the SNL type world for directing things.
Well, yeah, and I mean, he didn't write this exclusively by himself. He did write this with a writing partner who he had worked with on, I believe, Spy and The Heat, and that's Katie DiPold. And I think that there is evidence of a more serious, more earnest moments in the Kristen Wiig stuff that they have in the extended cut of the film that is removed from the theatrical cut, but it is only for her character. They don't have earnest emotion for the other characters in the film. And I would agree that it would be nice to see that in order for these characters to have a connection that doesn't feel as jokey all the time. Because it is very like light,
yeah. And not even when Melissa McCarthy is getting like you know argumentative and you know raising her voice and stuff, it still feels very. I'm gonna be the loud one in the improv scene, kind of like it doesn't really feel serious. And I don't want to lay all of this blame at Paul Feig's feet, because it's, you know, obviously it's a collaboration, but like, all of the actors, I think, are working as hard as they possibly can in all of these scenes to do what they need to do. There's just something so unstructured about everything else that it just makes it feel like we're watching dailies, kind of.
Yeah.
And I will give the movie credit that, like, when creepy weirdo dude electrocutes himself, you know, like on our way into the third act, I feel like the movie actually starts hitting some more structure that actually makes it feel more like a Ghostbusters movie and more just like a movie in general. But it's just so unfortunate that that's like an hour and 15 minutes into the movie. We've just been watching improv for so long. And it's just like, all right, can we do this, do some stuff now? And then like after, you know, say what you will about the circus ghosts scene stuff, like there's some interesting stuff in there. There's also a lot of stuff that doesn't make any sense. But that stuff wraps up pretty quickly compared to the long bit that we suffered through in the beginning.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. It's difficult to have these conversations because I do like all of the actors and actresses that are in the film. And I like Paul Feig as a person in general. But what you said, this does feel like dailies. It does feel like, you know, writer's room. It does feel like improv on a stage where you're just throwing stuff out there and then it's just all gold. Let's keep it all in there. And
it feels nice if you're watching a performance one night for an hour and then we all go back about our lives. But this is a film that we're putting on record forever. So people are going to like scrutinize it. It's not theater. It's film.
Yeah. And my favorite character in the film is, you know, Kate McKinnon's Jillian Holtzman. I think that it is an interesting and fun character, but it is a little one note because they didn't give us anything else that goes with it other than she's kind of wild in what she's willing to do with science to accomplish her things.
But again, doesn't it feel like they clinically broke down the original Ghostbusters on paper and were like, how can we pivot this into the modern era? Like, we need an Egon. Egon is, you know, boring and straightforward and kind of odd. And like they pivoted him into a new version of the Egon archetype or something. And it's like, all right, on paper, sure. But it's fun. And I think Kate McKinnon is probably one of the more fun things in the movie, but at the same time, it's just like, what is this in service of? Like, and again, it probably all comes back to just so much of it feeling like riffing in a room.
Yeah, I mean, I don't find as much fault with her performance or anything like that. I take a bigger issue, I think, with the main characters of our ensemble, which is a strange thing to say, but you can tell that the main characters really are Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy. And that Leslie Jones and Kate McKinnon play a supporting role in this, you know, quadrophenia. Okay. yeah, they're not as, up on the surface, but unfortunately that doesn't help because this is the part of Melissa McCarthy's career for me that I'm not as excited by, where it kind of seems to be these performances. Like, it feels like this character is not that far off from what she was doing in Bridesmaids.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you're just riffing on things and shouting stuff and like, my wontons and my wonton soup. And like, it is
repeated bit. It's a callback.
Yeah.
It's not just a repeated bit. It's a callback. I agree with you, but that does bring up another point, which I wanted to sort of discuss with you. When we are talking about like the Ghostbusters formula, does the original Ghostbusters, I guess one and two, does it feel like there's a main character in that movie to you? And if you had to pick a main character from Ghostbusters one, who would that be?
Venkman.
Venkman's the main character, you think?
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Interesting.
Because everything pivots off of Venkman, even though it is an ensemble cast. They need him for the Ghostbusters.
But like, Dana really kicks it all off, though, doesn't she?
Yeah, but Dana is affiliated with Venkman.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah,
she can't really be the main character in the third act because she's a dog.
But in the sequel, she is a big part of it, but this is after she broke up with Venkman. So again, that is the conduit for things happening. So Venkman is really what things pivot off of in that film.
Yeah.
But the serious conversations that move plot forwards are always with Ray and Egon, where you have Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis talking about stuff. And then whenever they need to break something down for the audience, they're always talking to Ray.
Peter.
Why am I blanking?
Oh, Winston?
Winston, yes. They're always breaking
is that more?
Yeah, well, because they're breaking stuff down for Winston or for Peter because they're not on the same level as
Winston's a regular guy and Peter doesn't care.
Yeah, they're not on the same level as you know, Egon and Ray, where they're talking about the stuff all the time, so they can kind of use shorthand between each other. And so that kind of is what informs the audience. And you don't have exactly that relationship here, although Leslie Jones is standing in for Winston, obviously, and Winston is her uncle that she borrows the hearse from.
Yeah.
But
in that original recipe of the characters there's something very deft about the way they move back and forth between those different characters, and then they create the ensemble. I don't even know how much of that stuff was intentional or if it was just the sort of magic when you put these characters together. I don't want to give them too much credit for saying that they did all of that stuff so specifically and so well, but it definitely feels like it's missing here. I mean, the characters in this movie, and again, I'm not trying to harp on them for being improv actors or whatever, harp on improv in general, but that's just kind of a good metaphor here. The characters in this movie do feel like they're all sort of yes-anding each other most of the way through the movie, and it doesn't quite have that same sort of... any conflict in this movie between the characters is a very different kind of conflict than the characters had in the original.
Yes.
You preface every reply with a deep sigh. Like, I can't tell if you're still walking back the Gamergate assholes or if it's just trying to, you know, give any validity to what I'm saying.
it can be both. Why not both? There's going to be a different relationship in this film, and I don't want them to reproduce attempt to reproduce the chemistry of the relationships that are in the first film, because I don't think that would have worked at all. But instead, you have a central relationship here between Kristen Wiig's Dr. Erin Gilbert and Melissa McCarthy's Dr. Abigail Yates, Abby. And they are former friends, and they butt heads over the book going out, and she's losing her job because she's, you know, participating in crackpot science and stuff. They don't do much with resolving the tension between them other than she just is back in the fold. And there isn't that like doubts raised again in the theatrical cut, between them, over like, oh, well, you know, maybe this is the wrong thing to do, or, you know, maybe I shouldn't be involved in this because this just isn't for me. You can do this by yourself, or any of that stuff where they can separate out these characters. Or have any sort of like conflict in between them. And instead we have like the sort of flimsy conflict of publishing the book and, you know, posting the video online and stuff and getting her fired. But it is immediately resolved and swept out of the way. And then, you know, these friends who haven't talked in years are now just friends again, without any sort of like awkwardness or bumps along the way, that one might expect. And
they're not very different characters either. Like one, like it's like, you know, there before the grace of God go I, kind of like one is more successful at a highly prestigious school and the other is less successful at a fake fly by night school. And then Holtzman is there for the comedy weirdo relief. But like, you know, all the original characters are all very strange and odd. And I mean, not saying they're more interesting, but they're definitely different, distinctly different, whereas the characters here, maybe not so much.
No, and I know that I wonder if some of that is intentional, where they wanted like that backstory part that's excised from the theatrical, where they believed in all the same stuff, did all the same stuff, were best friends, participated in everything together, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why they're so similar. However, that is unaddressed really in the film, in terms of that being the case. And it also doesn't address how they grew apart afterwards and things that may be different in their lives. And I can understand why one of the things that was cut from the film is just an attribute of Dr. Erin Gilbert is that she has a boyfriend. And that one of the other things about her is that she's just awkward in every situation and just sort of like bumbling through every scene, you know, talking to herself, being awkward. And that doesn't necessarily make her different than Melissa McCarthy in Melissa McCarthy's Abby in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. It just makes the things that she's saying different, but like they're both the same sort of level when it comes to this theoretical paranormal science. They're both the same ish, you know, when it comes to other attributes. Although we don't see Abby engineer anything as we do see, we don't see Erin Gilbert engineer anything as sometimes we see Abby assisting Holtz with stuff. So it doesn't have that same dynamic, as like, it doesn't have the same dynamic as like, you know, Peter and Egon or Peter and Ray.
Yeah. Or even like go Bridesmaids, go like Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph. Like they're very similar in terms of their personalities. They're old friends. Maya Rudolph is going off and getting married, but they're still like when they're having that lunch together, they're still being goofballs and weirdos together. But like Kristen Wiig's character in Bridesmaids is clearly very depressed and dealing with a lot of serious things. And Maya Rudolph is just kind of like, you know, she's at her wit's end and she's kind of over her friend's drama at a certain point. That's the conflict between them. Like those characters have more contrast than Abby and Erin and do in this one.
Yeah. And I wish they had more of that contrast because the conflict between them doesn't do much for us as the audience, but you know, they each get like funny little lines in the film. They're just not anything to do with the characterization of their characters, really. Dr. Erin Gilbert is constantly lusting after Kevin.
Knowing that she had a boyfriend in the other cut.
Yes. And they don't address that in the other cut either. But it's strange. But you have Melissa McCarthy just not lusting after Kevin and just kind of like pitying Kevin, which is slightly different than what Kristen Wiig's doing in those scenes. But that has nothing to do with the jokes they're telling in those scenes, because the jokes are Kevin's, you know, drew a hot dog over a house because the ghost did that.
And maybe that's mm-hmm. another thing that gets me too, is that so many of these jokes could be in any movie. Like, you know, is the sugar in the coffee and the sipping and the spitting it out and handing it back. And, you know, the phone in the aquarium, like none of those things have anything to do with the plot of this movie or even the setting of this movie. That a lot of it, that maybe that's another reason that I keep saying it feels like, you know, riffing unrelated to the story here. But, can you remind me again why Erin was separated from the other three, like when they get trapped under the balloon and she shows up to save the day? Like, why was she not there the whole time? Like, I feel like that's like a plot thing that they wanted to separate them and then bring them back together or something, but I can't think of an actual reason why.
I was just watching this before we started recording, because I'd watched the extended cut first and then I was revisiting the theatrical to see what the differences were. And in the theatrical, they skip over something that's in the extended, where Erin says that she needs to go home and she's trying to like get over, I forget what it was exactly in the extended cut, but she's trying to like, she's upset about something. She's trying to get over it. She's just got to go home and be by herself. And so she leaves there. And that is right before Melissa McCarthy gets possessed. And when she's at home, she sits in bed and looks at the book. In the theatrical cut, it just cuts from them being escorted out of the Hotel Mercado, and then she's just reading the book in her bed.
Right. Theoretically, everybody went home, but Melissa McCarthy went to the shop or whatever, and that's why she's alone there. She gets possessed through the sink.
Right. But in reality, there's a scene there in the shop before that.
Is there conflict? Do they like argue with each other and like go their separate ways? Because that would have been very useful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not really a conflict. She's like, I need time to myself. Like, I need alone time. And then she goes. And I don't remember specifically what she said. But, you know, it's Abby and Holtz and Patty all saying like, oh, no, stay. She says, I just need alone time. And she leaves. And then it's her reading the book in bed. Then it's Abby in the place by herself saying, did you guys forget your keys? And then it cuts to them showing up with the sandwich and saying, Abby, we got you a sandwich because you can't just pick off of ours. You've been having really bad mood swings, etc. And she's possessed and all the stuff is the same after that point. So, you know, it's strange because it kind of would fill in that gap a little bit, but it also doesn't make any sense in a movie that takes place post 1998, why you have Kristen Wiig wandering around Manhattan without being able to call and discuss this stuff with her coworkers and friends. Because in the film, when she reads the book and she discovers the plot, she calls and leaves a message on the answering machine at the office, like a 1980s answering machine with tape that has a speaker that says the whole thing. And this is when Abby's gone into the restroom and is possessed already about the whole thing about the plan. So instead of following up with them, she decides her best course of action is to go to hunt down the mayor to try to talk to him directly about this, and then go back to Chinatown to get her stuff, to go back again to then do the stuff, to go fight the ghosts, but not call again. This is a movie that was made in 2016 where no one has a cell phone.
Well, you see, they're very poor upstart Ghostbusters.
I get that. But sometimes people just have a cell phone for personal reasons or from a previous employer, perhaps. There should be some way to contact the people who are in the story that is not an answering machine or a walkie-talkie. But
they've got nuclear accelerators on their back, but they don't have telephones.
No, God forbid.
By the way, just as an aside, I found the characters. Elizabeth Perkins plays the rival professor lady.
Sure.
AKA the girlfriend from Big.
Sure.
Elizabeth Perkins is great. And I found the boyfriend, Justin Kirk. He's very creepy looking.
Yeah, I just not ringing a bell for me with her. She's not in very much of it. She just basically has that one little scene where she just dismisses everything Kristen Wiig says to undermine her. But that is, you know, just there. You can go back and watch the theatrical cut because that's basically one of the few things that's different.
Maybe I will.
Yeah.
I had another. Okay, so here's another question for you. This being a reboot, I don't know, you call it a reboot, you call it a spinoff, whatever you want to call it here. There are a lot of scenes in this movie that you knew they were going to do some references to things from the original franchise. How well they do them is often a very thin line between good and bad. And I think almost all of them in this movie fell on the bad side of that line. Do you feel like we needed so many of the like explaining building proton packs and like coming up with the name Ghostbusters? Oh, the news guy called us that. That's not what we're called. We have a very long, complicated scientific name. Like a lot of those things seemed extraordinarily clunky and sort of written for not even the lowest common denominator, but basically for people who have never heard of Ghostbusters. And I don't think anybody seeing this movie, I don't know, maybe some small children have never heard of Ghostbusters before, so they felt like they needed some of that stuff in there. But there's a lot of it in here, and I felt like a lot of it was not super great.
I think my issue with it is so much of it feels like you're solving backwards. you know where you want to go to. So then you need to just get to that point and you sort of work your way back from that. And that is odd because that leaves you with some stuff that doesn't feel supernatural. I don't mean supernatural. I mean super space natural. So the stuff like with the logo, let's say, where they can't decide on the logo, and
oh yeah,
they interview Kevin about it, and he has a ghost with boobs. And that's just sort of an internal joke with them about you know people criticizing the film and talking about women doing this, etc. Misogynistic kind of stuff. So that's there. But then you have in the subway artiste, our Banksy of mm-hmm. the Ghostbusters 2016 universe, he spray paints exactly the logo from the 1980s movie. This is
another one of those bits mm-hmm. that feels like it could be excised out of any movie. The whole, like, he's about to do it. Don't do it. I said, don't do it. And he starts doing it. He's like, I swear, I said, don't do it. And then like chases him away. And then, oh, look at that. He did the thing. Mm-hmm. It's such a like, just a reused bit. I mean, I guess whatever. I mean, they're trying to put a different spin on it, but it's just like, I don't know. It was unsurprising. And I was just waiting for it to be over. You knew what was going to happen. And again, maybe that's it. You're back solving to the logo, whatever. But mm-hmm. at least the new trap was cool. Like, I guess that's something that they put a spin on. It's like a tube, and then the foot pedal fires out.
Yeah, no, I don't take any issue with any of the technology stuff that they did. Hmm.
Well, I take issue with the multiple practice rehearsal alleyway scenes.
Well, the scenes were clumsy.
Yes, but the equipment itself was pretty cool.
Yeah, and I just... It bothers me, like, that logo, where it's just like, this is so obviously anachronistic to the world of this film, that it is from another dimension that this is coming from, really. Like, this is not anything that is inherently evolved from this space. The artist who's producing this thing would never have, like, why would they have done this? It doesn't really inspire me with confidence when they do stuff like that, or when they have the ghost jumpers or whatever, the like the Sci-Fi Channel ghost hunting thing spoof.
Oh sure, yeah, these are the people who are ruining our reputation as real ghost peoples.
Yeah. And then the news says Ghostbusters and they're like, it's not our name, and then they start going by it. Mm-hmm. Like you said, because they're back solving for that. But
so
then you
many
also
of these pieces are like, if you know the Ghostbusters franchise, you'll go, oh, hey, that's that thing. And if you've never heard of the Ghostbusters franchise, you're just like, oh, that was a little bit of fun. But so much of it is just like that, maybe gets half a smile out of you, but serves no real purpose other than that. And again, I don't want to say the whole movie is like that, because they do actually start doing plot related things after dude electrocutes himself. And, you know, the actual plan becomes somewhat evident with their lane lines and, you know, mirrors and stuff. And Slimer driving the car.
That's another thing. Slimer. Why Slimer? Because Slimer is not inherently... like, he wasn't a ghost member's cast, but he was an iconic ghost that was in the original film, so much so that he appeared in the real Ghostbusters cartoon show as mm-hmm. a co-worker, essentially, with the Ghostbusters. And that is very different from his depiction in the films. And again, he is here along with... Mrs. Slimer, I don't know exactly what was going on there.
If we're using the Pac-Man naming convention, then yes, that would be Mrs. Slimer.
Or Ms. Slimer, I guess.
Ms. Slimer.
I don't know. Ms. Slimer, if you're nasty. I don't know how the ghost chooses to identify, but... It is just Slimer with a blonde wig and red lipstick on.
Just like a gremlin would be.
Yeah, it is exactly like the female gremlin in Gremlins 2. And it is just like, why are we doing this? But
this is the thing. Like, They know. I'm not saying they knew the extent to which the general audience held these pieces of IP sacred, but they should have had some inclination that what they were doing, like, they have all of these pieces at their disposal, and they're burning a lot of IP for some really modest returns, like really modest returns. Like, Slimer's here. We're using Slimer, and he's driving the car, shouting. He drives away. He comes back. He's got to miss a Slimer. And then they drive into the portal.
Yeah. And, I mean, is that any better than when Slimer shows up and he's eating, like, stuff in the hotel and it's a big mess and all this other stuff? But that's part of, like, an educational process for our characters, because they're dealing with a sort of, like, lower-level ghost at the time. Whereas in this film, that sort of thing is taken over by the green dragon ghost thing, which I guess is the ghost of a dragon. but the
ghost of a dragon. That's a good point. This being a reboot, they did a lot of things. They yes-anded a lot of the world building. Like, you've got dragons. You've got new pieces of equipment. You know, you've got your vacuum wood chipper thing, which whatever is fine. But, like, you've got proton pack guns that are built to not just catch the ghosts, but also to kill them. They even don't feel like they fully explored their logic with that, because it's just a big circus ghost battle scene. They're just like, they're blasting them, which grabs them, and then they're just like yanking them, which I guess is like, if you yank a ghost hard enough with a proton stream, it just breaks it into a bunch of mist. Apparently that's the world we're in here now.
Well, they sort of like yanked and then threw it, and then it's like, well, it does the ghost collide at that point with something and then it hurts them? It doesn't make it a lot of sense. It's not like you threw a person.
No. No, that scene was very actiony and very cool, especially Holtzman doing all the cool, like, little pistol stuff at the end there. That was very, like, you know, finale fireworks clap, everyone.
Yeah. I mean, the best part, inarguably, in the entire film is when Holtzman licks the tip of whatever that nuclear handgun thing is that is attached to her backpack,
which is why it was in the trailer. It's in like the DVD menu for the whole thing. it's cool and actiony and dramatic, but it doesn't, like, the whole scene makes no sense. Like, the giant, you know, 30-foot tall circus man on stilts that's directing the ghosts to attack them, like, why, what, like, the you know, when the ghosts got out in Ghostbusters 1, it was just chaos because they were running around the city. They're ghosts from New York and they're just doing whatever they feel like. It's not like they weren't directed to attack. Like, this is another thing too. Like, this movie has a bad guy who has a plan and is also theoretically leading the bad ghosts to do something. Like, they were going to go do something, maybe just cause chaos. But then when he realized that there was Ghostbusters coming to get him, like, his plan quickly became release all the ghosts to attack the Ghostbusters.
Yeah, well, he, in the extended cut, after the dance is over, he ends it by noticing that the Ghostbusters are coming. Although, he doesn't really notice the Ghostbusters are coming. The camera is looking in vaguely the direction the Ghostbusters might be walking from, although you don't really see them. And then he says something in ADR, or, you know, Kevin says something in ADR anyway, or, well, sorry, this is complicated. Chris Hemsworth as Rowan in the body of Kevin.
I understand what you're
in
saying.
In ADR says that the Ghostbusters are coming and he'll give them, you know, a taste of old New York is what he says, basically. And yeah, so
there's one line, like, when he sicks the large tall ghosts on them, he says something about old New York. But I'd be curious to know if in the extended cut, is there more explanation to the Macy's Day Parade evil ghost balloons?
None exists. And that, I think, is the reference that bothered me the most, is when you get to the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, Macy's Day Parade balloon. Because why is the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man a Macy's Day Parade balloon in the universe of this movie? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, because this movie, potentially like the next one, lives in a world where the original Ghostbuster movies happened but it was so long ago and we've been through so much that ghosts are just now like, eh, whatever. Like that happened and we forgot about it. Like it's not a big deal anymore. So I could see where Stay Puft became like, you know, again, a piece of IP that somebody made a balloon of and now it's just tradition to be in the parade. Because like even earlier when they're talking to the mayor and they're like, the cat's out of the bag, and they have the whole put the cat back in the bag. Well, the cat's out of the bag. How does it go back in the bag? You can't put the bag in. Like that whole back and forth thing is like, I think the mayor says these sorts of things happen.
Well, you can't put my cat back in the bag because it's a dog.
Right, of course. Can I bring my cat to work with me? You have a cat? No, I have a dog. It's named My Cat. Mike Hat. Like
short for Michael Hat.
Michael Hat. That this is a scene that made it into the theatrical cut. But the mayor says something like, you know, this happens sometimes and the cat always goes back in the bag. I think what he's referencing is the fact that the first two Ghostbusters movies happened in the 80s and the people of New York were like, wow, that was crazy. We live in New York. Crazy stuff happens. Let's move on to the next crazy thing.
No, that's not what's happening. This movie is firmly not in the same universe as the original Ghostbusters.
Give me your evidence.
The filmmakers said it's not.
Did they really?
Yeah, like the cameos also by the people from Ghostbusters in this. You know, it's not. It's just not.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that they have basically everyone, including a bust of the head of Harold Ramis.
Yeah,
but they're all playing different characters. Bill Murray's character has a funny hat on and is very skeptical about ghosts. Mm-hmm. Ray is a cab driver with a bad accent. And Winston owns a funeral home. Oh, and Sigourney Weaver's there.
Yeah, she's the mentor of Holtz. Yeah.
She's got a popped collar.
And Annie Potts is the hotel receptionist, Vanessa.
Sure, yes, of course. She's there. Did it feel better or worse that they made cameos as different characters?
I don't care.
I mean, but if you were going to have cameos from the original characters, would you want them to sort of like wink and a nod, we're different people now, or would you want them to be the same people?
Well, they could only be the same people if this is a universe where the Ghostbusters existed.
I suppose. But so. I think that is really the only thing in this movie that would make it in the same universe or not. Like there's not a whole lot of other connective tissue that would really connect the universes.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, is they're not connected, but they have these cameos because they're tying in the property.
Yeah, but if the characters making cameos were just named the way they were in the original, I think that would just, that's all you would need to do to put this in the other universe.
But it's not what they did. They did the opposite of that.
I realized that.
I think that's one of the things, though, is like, again, going back to what we said at the start of this, it creates the situation where it is now artificially this movie, which exists in a world where the Ghostbusters had existed for 20 years, up against them like inventing all this stuff from scratch and existing, you know, it creates this weird like conflict outside of the film where you have to reconcile why are they doing these choices inside of the film to echo something else that is a different film. And there are other reboots and refreshes and things that that do this sort of stuff, this wink and nod, etc. Like when we talked about Lost in Space, they had several of the main cast of Lost in Space return and play different roles inside of the movie Lost in Space. It didn't help, and that was a terrible movie. But that, I guess, is not a great example. But you can see it in other areas as well.
The question
TV
with these reboots is always, how far do you divorce it from the original property? How far in a new direction do you try to go, knowing that it is a reboot and people are going to know it's a reboot and you're going to do all these winks and nods? Like, how far do you try to push it away from the original so it stands on its own? And this one, they tried to keep it very far away, which meant they had to kind of reinvent the wheel with a lot of this stuff to make it exist in the movie.
I really wonder what the reception of this movie would have been like had this existed in the same universe.
Yeah.
That these are doctors who are coming at this, you know,
like
years...
if your book was based on research, like from when they were kids watching the original stuff happen in New York, and that's what sort of like invigorated their interest in ghosts, but there haven't been any ghosts since then because they all got captured or whatever, and then they went their separate ways and then came back together.
Yeah. I mean, God knows what the reasoning is in the next movie. Not even next, the sidestep of this movie, the third-ish sort of thing. Anyway, there's also, we didn't discuss this earlier, because I have not played it, but there is a video game that features the original cast of Ghostbusters, and I believe Dan Aykroyd wrote or produced some part of it. And so he considers that to be the unofficial third Ghostbusters movie.
Oh, does he now?
Which is you know, quite a statement from him. I wouldn't really invest a lot in any statements from Dan Aykroyd personally.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
I mean, unless you plan on paying him for an appearance and then telling him he's allowed to talk about his vodka line, I wouldn't really like put stock in anything he has to say. But it is interesting to think about, like, you know, what would this have been like if it was the same universe? It didn't try to reformulate anything from the original film, where everybody's just moving on from this instead of like discovering ghosts from the first time. You know, you lose out on that, but you also have these characters who get to interact with a richer universe and also a more coherent universe where they don't have to act like they're inventing a thing that the audience knows about already, you know?
Yeah. Plus if you're already sort of accepting an established tone, you can work to fit it into that rather than just trying to find your way through it the whole way.
Yeah. And I guess that gets us into sort of this thing of like, well, were the original films so spectacularly good that we should make an extension of them as they were today?
I don't even know if that's the question. I think the question is there enough established, just like, not even like story canon or something, but like, are we already moving far enough in a certain direction that we should maintain some of that momentum as opposed to putting the brakes on the entire thing and saying, we're going this way now? Like, should you just kind of go with the flow at a certain point? Because there are not expectations, but just like, this franchise is this because it is this, not because it's great, but just because that's what this is. And if you're going to do one of these, like, there are certain things that you got to do. Like, if you're going to make an Indiana Jones movie, you should probably have Indiana Jones in it. Like, I don't mean to be overly simplistic, but like, if you're going to make a Ghostbusters movie, it's like, here's some tenets that should probably exist in it, and just accept those and work within a little bit of a framework. But, and again, I'm sure they considered all these things. There are very smart people being paid lots of money to have these conversations, but they took a big swing and took a big step to the side with this one, and it just didn't really work. And I don't think any of that has to do with, you know, the validity of the talent, behind the movie. It certainly isn't because they were trying to rewrite our childhoods. it was just like, they tried a thing. They tried a mid 20 teens thing with some very talented people who were doing some similar things in their careers at the time. And that recipe just, it was just a little lackluster.
Yeah. I mean, I know I have gushed over the ridiculousness and silliness and bizarreness of Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. And that is a Kristen Wiig movie where Kristen Wiig plays two different characters, and it is absolutely silly through and through. But it is interesting to me that something like that is a funnier movie to watch than something like this, where they're trying to conform to this rigid formula of how they think they can approach rebooting Ghostbusters. And I know that it's because the talent that exists there, that Kristen Wiig is genuinely funny. And just for some reason, like how she is wedged in here is not coming across that way. I know Melissa McCarthy is genuinely funny. Just how she is in here, it's just not functioning in terms of storytelling for this. And I know Leslie Jones is hilarious, and so is Kate McKinnon. And
Kate McKinnon, funny in all instances except her Verizon commercials. I'm sorry, Kate McKinnon. When you're doing that weird sort of like song and dance, I don't know how to walk in heels, but you do walk.
Not well, I see your Verizon commercial, and I raise you a Tostitos.
Oh, with Dan Levy?
Yes.
I like those commercials where they're having the like silent conversation.
It's not even a silent conversation. They're telepathic about tortilla chips.
You have lipstick on your teeth. Okay, first of all, rude.
But
I like those commercials. They're certainly much shorter and more humor end up in the brain. Yeah, sure. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, but anyway, like I know that it could exist, that there could be a funny movie that could have come out of this process and these people and everything. It didn't happen, and it makes me sad.
It's not that it's entirely unfunny. It's just, it's fine. It's just not, it missed the mark for...
It needs to be better than fine, though, is the unfortunate reality.
It needs to be better than fine. It needs to be better than fine for it to be a movie that we enjoy, and it needs to be better than fine, frankly, for it to be a Ghostbusters movie, because, like, we want... If you're gonna take all this IP out of the vault and put it in front of people and say, "Remember Ghostbusters that you love," you need to come with something better than this. And it's not because you're gonna make us sad about our childhoods. It's because this is just a misuse of that intellectual property. Again, from an artistic standpoint, I should shut up about this because I'm sure they made money. Whatever. But like,
I don't have the same amount of certainty as you do.
They made some money.
some money changed hands. But
a lot of people enjoyed this movie. I looked back through Letterboxd to see what the reviews were from it from all the people that I follow, and there were, you know, it was like split between like 2-star reviews and like 4.5-star reviews. And it was like, maybe again, that's that line you were talking about before, like which side of the political spectrum do you fall on?
Yeah,
but
that's gross the thing.
Worldwide of $230 million.
I don't believe what anyone had to say about it in 2016.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, I still feel the same way about this film as I felt when I saw it. But at the same time, I knew that when I was talking to other people about it, that the people I was talking to were either very for in a way that I was not, or very against in a way that I could never be.
So those stars on Letterboxd, they're grading on a curve, you think, probably.
Yeah, because I do wonder if you put this movie back in front of those same people who gave it 4.5 stars, and you're like, you want another go at that, and then see what they say. Because, like you said, this is a fine movie. There's some funny stuff in here. Like, I genuinely laugh when Andy Garcia says that, you know, "Don't ever compare me to the mayor from Jaws."
Jaws. Yeah, that's very funny.
It's a very funny line. He's delivered well. Like, I laughed at that. It is not that this movie is unfunny.
No.
But it is.
If this were a separate property, like Spy or Bridesmaids or something, like, you would know what you're in for. But for some reason, when they try to take that and mix it with Ghostbusters, it's a little too oil and water. It doesn't taste good.
I think if you took the yoke off of this, of it being Ghostbusters, of it being this intellectual property thing, and you just said, like, hey, you know what? You're 4 women who are in New York or Boston, and you just happen to go after ghosts. Like, here you go. No strings attached. You don't need to use the logo. You don't need to have proton packs. You don't need to... name check Slimer or any of this stuff. You don't need to have Bill Murray in your movie. Like, you can just approach this from a completely different standpoint. I believe you could have a movie that may not be necessarily much like way better than this, but might be less burdened than this movie is.
It certainly wouldn't have the social discourse that this one has. It probably wouldn't be much different or better, but yeah, it would be detached from a lot of expectations. Maybe that's what the next Sex and the City movie can be.
Oh,
you know, since the one guy's dead, you know, he could be a ghost.
Well, I mean, talk about burden with expectations. I was not a big Sex and the City fan, but all of the homosexuals that I follow on Twitter are very angry to the point of saying, did all the characters from Sex and the City have a lobotomy before they started, you know, this series and blah, 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 blah. Like, people are upset about it. So
I didn't watch the new one. I just heard about the things.
People are upset.
Anyway. I've seen far too much of the original, though.
I didn't watch a lot. I watched the one where they went to Los Angeles, and then she she gets a knockoff bag. Anyway,
yeah, she goes to the valley to get a knockoff bag, and I think doesn't Carrie make out with Vince Vaughn or something?
Sure. man,
he's not Vince Vaughn in the show. He's not Entourage. He's an up and coming actor, or she thinks he's an actor, but he's actually an assistant or something.
Are you excited for when the reboot of Entourage happens?
No. I've seen if you combine the pieces of Entourage I've seen, I've probably seen two episodes, not two full episodes, mind you, and that is more Entourage than I ever need to see in my entire life.
I think I saw the first season and the first episode of the second season, and then I was like, you know what, this isn't actually that good. So I didn't keep watching it.
I remember when I saw the one where he's making the firefighters movie, and the crazy director's like, I want you to really crash the car, and I'm going to hang out here in the car with my little red camera. Remember the red camera? And we're going to do it together, buddy. It's going to be awesome. I can't remember the director's name who was in that. It was one of the well-known director.
Was it Peter Berg?
No. It was his dad was a director, too. God, what's his name? He's like an angry, intense tattoo neck guy. Anyway,
I don't know. I saw a photo of Rawson Marshall Thurber the other day, and I was like, I'm sorry, you shouldn't look like you're in the movies you direct.
Who?
Rawson Marshall Thurber.
Rawson Marshall. How do you spell that?
R A W S O N space.
Oh, okay. I was way off.
Yeah.
Rawson Marshall Thurber.
Yeah. He's your Red Notice guy.
Oh, I haven't watched Red Notice yet.
Yeah. He also did Skyscraper, Central Intelligence, We're the Millers, Dodgeball, A True Underdog
Story.
We're
the Millers is very good.
I really genuinely like We're the Millers. We should talk about that someday. I've proposed it many times that it is
say about it. It's a fun movie to watch. We watch it a lot, but
yeah. What if they did We're the Millers, but it was the Ghostbusters, where they were impersonating being a family that busts ghosts? Anyway, just an idea I'm throwing out there for how they can really gel all of these intellectual properties together into one ball of vomit. But
it's really what we need.
Yeah, the ball of vomit. But the you know, I don't know. I feel conflicted because this movie is not what I would like it to be in order to give it praise.
Yeah.
And this movie is better than what people say it is when they're pooping on it from a place of ignorance and fear and loathing that I don't identify with. But it is weird what the result of that is now that there is a Ghostbusters Afterlife, that there is a world in which that exists, which sidesteps around this. And now Sony gets to memory hole this, gets to pretend that Ghostbusters 2016 didn't exist, gets to rename it Ghostbusters Answer the Call, gets to put it down somewhere on a low shelf because they've lost any faith or confidence in it.
Yeah, despite having set this up to be a franchise movie as well, because there is a very, very post-credit scene, which I assume you saw, where, again, the writing is so bad, but they very, very, very clumsily name-check Gozer. So,
Zool.
Oh, right, Zool. Sorry.
Yeah. But that's important for
I heard something
Gozer.
Weird. What's Zool? Meanwhile, in the background, I call this the Nutcracker because it cracks walnuts. The writing is so bad. I'm sorry.
I honestly, maybe all the riffing would have been improved if you had a better underlying story to work from. I think that perhaps the actors would have been freer to do alternate takes but then you'd still have something you could go back to and be like, yeah, we need this for the plot, or something.
If you were able to maintain a through line versus like in this scene, all we really need to do is establish what that you're called Ghostbusters, whatever it might be, or like you're hiring this guy. You know, if that's the only thing in the scene, yeah, you're going to get a 2-minute riff about you have a dog named Mike Hat. But if there was something more to do in that scene and you could just riff a little bit around it, maybe it would be a little bit more coherent. I don't know.
Yeah. And like, there is some interesting stuff in here. Like the art, just the structure of the film. It is, I like that there is a guy who is trying to use technology to bring about the destruction of modern civilization because he feels left out of it, and that this is his revenge on everybody else, because it is that commentary on the sort of like incel red pill garbage crap. And it is also interesting.
And we would love them all to electrocute themselves.
Yeah, it is interesting the way he enacts his plan is to kill himself, because this is a ghost movie. He becomes the powerful ghost villain that you have to deal with.
He becomes the ghost Joker.
Yeah. And, you know, it is what makes this, I think, more interesting than what it would be otherwise if you had just tried to mirror it directly and you had, like, Gozer or the Gozerian on top of the building at the end. If you had tried to reproduce Ghostbusters with this cast, then I think you wouldn't have had a good movie either. Like, we were talking about the weakness of the script. If you took the script of the original Ghostbusters and you said, all right, you actors are now these characters and you will go do this movie, I don't think that it would be well received either, because that would not be original. It would be strangely dated, and it would also not have the sort of modern angle on it or unexpected moments in it, because we would just be watching the same thing play out again. Like how I feel when I watched Denis Villeneuve's Dune, where it's like I can predict everything that's going to happen, and it is weird because I'm like, seeing
that's
a different
Dune.
Yeah, but this is like, this is Dune, and I'm seeing a different version of Dune in my mind as I'm watching it. You know, it is weird. And so you wouldn't want to do that with Ghostbusters. But at the same time, it's like, you know, this is a thing where we're not going to have that sort of like clever twist used again. And I am sort of hesitant about when we talk about Ghostbusters Afterlife, because I don't know what my reaction will be to that, because from the trailers, I know that they're like, remember nostalgia? Like, because we do, and that's all this is nostalgia. And I hope that there is something else in these things that is going to be interesting. Although, who knows? It might be a strange scenario where it winds up being as flawed as something like this, where it winds up being fine. And then maybe we'll have another variant of Ghostbusters trying to take some part of this crown forward into some other part of this. I don't know. It's going to be strange. And then at the end of that, we'll have Ghostbusters Into the Multiverse, where they cross the streams, so to speak. And we have all of the Ghostbusters together fighting ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have a pretty good idea how you're going to react to Afterlife. I'm curious to see if I'm right.
As you've already seen it.
I have seen it.
Mm. How do you think I will react? No. Well, don't tell me.
I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah. Then it would inform my opinion.
Color reviewing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't want to then be burdened by trying to like buck your opinion, because
no,
buck you, Dan. But yeah, that's I think all we can really say about Ghostbusters 2016: Afterlife is that it didn't deserve the garbage it got, and at the same time, it needed to be improved to really like take that mantle that it was burdened with taking. So,
yeah.
And other metaphors.
And other metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
People like Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Because they ain't afraid of no ghosts.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I just found a behind-the-scenes green screen photo that makes me very unhappy.
Hmm.
How do I... Oh, I still can't. I can't copy an IMDb photo, can I? Wait, does this work? Yeah, it does.
And it is interesting when you say this, and then I gotta wait. Oh, yeah. I never saw this photo.
Me neither.
I heard some things, so...
Oh, you heard some things?
Anyway, that is the end of our conversation about...
Oh, yeah, we're definitely done.
Ghostbusters 2016.
We love you, Ghostbusters.
Da-na-da-na-da-na. Blah, 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 blah. To the bone, and no one says you're better off alone.